Do you think you may have a problem with your alcohol consumption or drug use? Are you thinking about quitting and want to know what all the sober hype is about? Whatever the reason, I'm so grateful you're here with me today. My name is Sarah, and I am the creator and host of Sober Gratitudes. I once was an active alcoholic, and after decades of failed attempts to control my drinking, I finally reached out for help. Letting others help me is why I am here today, living a life I never thought possible. The suffering of my past was the catalyst I needed to find recovery and be receptive to healing. I created this podcast out of the desire to recover out loud and, with the help of my guests, show you how a better life is possible after addiction. Whether you have been here before or you are a first-time listener, I would be so grateful if you would take a moment to write a review on Apple Podcasts so that it can reach more people who may be struggling. Together, we can help those in need. You can also reach me at sobergratitudes@gmail.com with any questions or comments. Thank you again for dropping in today, and welcome to Sober Gratitudes. Sober Gratitudes podcast is proud to come together and partner with Valor Fitness Clothing in our mutual mission to support and encourage the recovering community. Based in Los Angeles and inspired by real recovery, Valor Fitness lives up to its mission. With one item sold, Valor Fitness donates one item to a homeless shelter or transitional rehab facility. Because Valor Fitness Clothing supports Sober Gratitudes mission, everyone can receive a discount when shopping. Use the code GRATITUDE20 at checkout. Also, every guest on my podcast will be graciously given a gift certificate from Valor. We're stronger together when we come together. Well, hi, everyone. Welcome to Sober Gratitudes. My name is Sarah, and I am the creator and host of this podcast. I'm so happy you're here with us today for what's going to be a really fun episode, we're going to keep it really serious, Chris. We're going to cry and we're going to be...
Thanks for having me. I don't know about crying, but...
I'm going to get you to cry. That's my goal. Yes. That's my goal today, is to get you to cry.
Good luck.
We've known each other now, how long?
Just about 2 years.
That's right, because you just...
I came in June of 19. Yeah.
And then when we met and talked for the first time, you had a couple months under your belt, right?
Not even. Probably like 4 to 6 weeks. Four, six weeks. Maybe 8 weeks tops. Like, it was funny because my image of you was very prim and proper from the meetings. And then the first time I got on the phone with you, you're cursing like a sailor. And I'm like... Wow, this isn't what I thought you would like, but I like that because you are real, you know, so that was good for me. That was good too, you know, just to have you just you know, you weren't this stuffy, you know, stuffy person that were you. You were just a regular person like me, you know. And
you thought I was a stuffy person.
No, not stuffy, but I remember seeing you at meetings and you look very, you know, you're very well put together, obviously. And I remember you sharing at meetings, and I just remember thinking, well, she's very well put together, this woman. And you are, don't get me wrong, but no, it was just funny. It was different than I expected, because you're on the phone, you're like, you know, like cursing like a sailor. And I'm like, do you curse on this podcast? You probably do.
Yes,
right?
I was just, right,
yeah, you're like, yeah. Fuck this, fuck that, you know, and I was like, so it just, like, I needed that in that moment too early on. You know, I needed somebody to talk to me like a sailor. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, pretty much like a sailor, because that's how I talk.
So these two sailors met.
Yeah.
2 years ago. So, and the rest is history.
The rest is history.
So, Chris, you. How long was your drinking career?
That's an interesting question, because I started, my first drunk was at 14, and then I started, you know, I didn't drink again until I was the summer before my senior year of high school. So I drank pretty much regularly from 17 on. But it, there were ebbs and flows with, you know, when, you know, like it wasn't always, it became a train wreck in the last few years.
What made it go from just, you are a social drinker, like I'm assuming you weren't, it wasn't a problem until like the last couple of years. Like,
yeah. So I drank hard in college, but like, to me, that was just what you did, you know, right. And there were no consequences. I didn't have any consequences. Everybody got in any trouble or anything like that. You know, I graduated, so it just, to me, I just had a typical sort of college, quote unquote, partying life, you know? And then I graduated and I started working. I was in my 20s. I was single and I was still partying very hard. And I was like drinking very hard. And it was just alcohol. No other drugs or anything like that. But I had this attitude about life, like work hard and play hard. So I was just all into my career and my work. But then when I was off, like my friends and I, and most of them were people I worked with, you know, we drank heavy and we partied and we got crazy and all that sort of stuff. And that was kind of, I lived like that for a number of years in my 20s. Then I wound up meeting my wife when I was 28, getting married at 30. My older son was born when I was 31, and all that stopped, you know, and it just kind of stopped by it stopped by default because I needed, you know, I just needed to, you know, I needed to focus on being a parent and being a husband and, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And I was still very involved with my career, very into my career. And, my wife had stopped working when my older son was born. So, I had to pick up a second job. So I just was, it just, you know, and I was sick of the partying at that point. I was, you know, I was like 30, 31. I was like, I didn't want to drink like I did in my 20s at that point. So I spent a good, probably 15 years where I just was a social drinker. You know, I really didn't drink that much. I'd have one beer with dinner sometimes. I'd go out with friends maybe two or three times a year to dinner, have a few drinks. Like I lived like that through my 30s into my early 40s. And when I look back on it, it's becoming clearer and clearer. I was dealing with a lot of stuff over the years, from my 20s through my 30s, both a lot of it was personal stuff, family stuff and, you know, family members with addiction, family members with health issues, all sorts of stuff that a lot of us deal with, you know, but it's not unique to me, but I was dealing with all that. And I was always, at the same time, my career, I worked in law enforcement for 25 years. So my career was a very stressful career. And I was exposed to a lot of negativity. I'll say that, you know, exposed to a lot of negativity. It's kind of the nature of the job, you know? So through the years, I was always seen as like the rock, like with my family and I was always seen as like, oh, Chris is the one that will give the advice. And that was my role. I give the advice. I solve the problems. I, am the one that has it all together while everybody else around me is kind of falling apart. And then the nature of my job, you know, was to solve other people's problems. You know, people call the police and because, not because they're having a great day, you know, because something's going wrong and you need to go and solve their problem. So I spent so many years just feeling like I was just solving problems and I had to be this rock. So I realized now I was stuffing a lot of emotional stuff down through the years. And then, what happened in 2016 specifically, in 2016, my father, who I was close with, he passed away. And then 5 weeks later, my mother-in-law passed away. And it was just like this 1-2 punch. And something just kind of triggered me. And I just, I just got this fuck it attitude. Like, I just was like, I didn't care anymore. That had to all come out. It was like 15, 20 years of stuff that just had to come out. So it came out in me trying to escape through alcohol. And I did, you know, and I did that for a lot of years. And I just started drinking like I was in college again, going out with friends to the bars, not coming home from work, after work, going to the local bars and just drinking all night long, never, you know, get home at 4 a.m. I mean, I was worse probably then than I was in my 20s. Not probably, definitely. And so, like I said, I didn't realize I was self-destructing at the time, but I look back on it, I think that's kind of how I look at it. That's what happened. Was it was like this volcano that was just simmering and simmering and simmering underneath the surface, and then it just eventually it had to come out, and it came out with me just wanting to escape through alcohol.
Yeah. And what was your last drunk like?
It was a bender for a few days. It was June of 2019, 2 years ago. And I had, when I talk about, I'd gone through a lot of personal stuff. One of the things that I had gone through was within 1 year, the year prior to me getting sober, within 1 year, I had two friends of mine commit suicide that I worked with. And one of them was a very close friend for like 25 years. So, my last drunk was kind of like this bender. My second friend committed suicide, in June of 2019. And it just, again, it was like, everything was cumulative, all this stuff was just throughout my whole life was happening. And then when my second friend committed suicide, 10 months later, it just was so hard to deal with, And so I remember going to the wake, going to his wake, and then I left and I didn't come home till like 5 a.m. I just was out drinking. And I don't remember if I went to work the next day or not. If I did, I just slogged through on a few hours sleep. I don't remember. But I basically, if I did go to work, I think I started drinking probably that afternoon at work, because the last few years I had an office job and an administrative role. So I wasn't, I was working in an office. I wasn't out on the street. And then that next night I just drank my face off. The next night I just drank my face off. I wound up losing the night after his wake. I went to a city near us, Jersey City. And I just went by myself, and I just went to these bars, and I just was drinking my face off, and I lost my car. I say lost because, I guess it got stolen, but it just literally disappeared. I went back the next day, went back 2 days later. I checked, called the tow yards, called the police. It was never, to this day, never found. So I don't know what happened to that car, but maybe it was God protecting me from getting behind the wheel. And killing myself or somebody else, God forbid. So that happened the day after the wake, and then I got a rental car. So that was a claim on my insurance. Obviously, I filed a report that my car was stolen. That was a claim on my insurance policy. So then I get a rental car, and then I go out drinking my face off, driving the rental car around. And the night before I went to my first recovery meeting, I cracked up the rental car. I barely remember this, but I sideswiped. I don't even know where it was. I sideswiped a bunch of parked cars, kept going. And then, that was another insurance claim 3 days later on the rental car, all the cost of that. So now that was kind of what did it for me. Like, I woke up that next morning. It was a Friday morning. It was June 7th. And I woke up and realized, I need help, because I had tried to stop, like a lot of people talk about, I experienced that. I tried to stop on my own, in those few years prior, and I would stop for a month, 2 months, 3 months, but I could never stay stopped.
But this time was different. This time
you,
and let's talk about that, because for me, what I have found is that people who find themselves in a place of complete and utter desperation are usually the ones that are motivated, like internally motivated.
Right.
Or some kind of higher power is motivating them.
Sure.
To surrender, to just let go. And do you feel like, it sounds like that's where you were at?
Absolutely. I mean, it was fear. I mean, I just woke up with this feeling of dread and complete fear. Like, I'm going to kill myself, or I'm going to God forbid, I'm going to kill somebody on the road driving drunk. And it was just fear. And I was destroying my life, and it was going to end bad, either me dead or in prison.
You could see that was something that was like clearly like so apparent to you in that moment.
It hit me that moment when I woke up. So I do look back on that now as a God moment. I do look back on that as a spiritual experience. You know, I look back on that as my first of a bunch since I've been in recovery, mm-hmm. but that was the first one. I mean, because I can't explain what was different that day. You know, I don't know. I just knew, I don't know. It just was, that's why I feel like it was a spiritual experience, and it was God. I knew something was different. And I said, I need help. I can't, all this stuff about me telling me that, and I didn't know anything about all the stuff that we talk about, like, that we have a disease that, you know, talks to us in our own voice. I wasn't in recovery, so I didn't know any of that. Now I can look back and I see all that happened, that happened with me, through that last year, year and a half. I can see all that, but at the time I didn't know that. I didn't know any of that stuff. I'd never been to any type of a recovery meeting, and, you know, hadn't been to the steps, obviously. And
Chris, when you got to that, when you were at that moment of like, I can't do this anymore, did you go to a detox or a rehab?
No, I didn't need to go to I didn't need to go to a detox. I'll say that. Whether or not I would have benefited from a rehab, I guess is debatable, but I didn't need to go. Like I never detoxed. I never went through withdrawals from not drinking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So like I didn't, you know, yeah, it wasn't, I never went through that. So,
opened your laptop and looked up recovery meetings.
I was in bed and I went on my phone and I just started, I Googled AA meetings near me. I Googled that the closest ones were, now this was like 10 o'clock in the morning. The closest ones were like 6-7 o'clock at night, right near my house. But I was so nervous that I was going to kind of like chicken out and not go. Like if I had that much time to think about it, I would convince myself I didn't need to go. Mm. I found one at 12:15 that was a little bit further away from my house, but it was sooner. And I just knew, I said, I need to go to this one. I need to get to one as soon as possible. And lo and behold, was where we met originally.
Awesome. And so when you walked into that room, what was that experience like?
Oh, it was nerve-wracking. It was nerve-wracking. Oh my God, I was so nervous and I didn't know what to expect. I just was so nervous.
But what happened?
Well, what happened was everybody was so welcoming and everybody was so nice. I couldn't believe it. I was like, I wasn't used to people being that nice, you know? Mm-hmm. Again, I'll go back to what I did for a living. I mean, I worked in a pretty urban area, so very urban area. So I was used to, you know, my whole life, it was just a lot of conflict and people not wanting you there and, you know, and confrontational, just the nature of what I did for a living. And I just, this was like the total opposite. Everybody was so nice, so welcoming. There was one guy that actually gave me a hug and said that he was glad I was here. And I just was like, it was overwhelming, but in a good way. You know, it was like, mm-hmm. I just was stunned. I was like, what's going on? Why are they so nice? Like, you know? So it was just, but I'll tell you what, that made all the difference in the world. I mean, that's what got me to come back the next day.
What has your life been like now that you have been sober?
Well, it's only gotten better, you know? So obviously, you know, I've learned this and I'm still learning this in early recovery, you know, life on life's terms. I mean, I still have a lot of the same stressors, you know, that I had before I came into recovery. But what's happened is I've learned how to deal with it without turning to alcohol to numb myself through it. And, you know, I also, you know, I say this a lot too, like, you know, those first few months, like I said earlier, those first few months, I really just had to focus on just not picking up a drink when I got agitated and angry, which was a lot. But after a few months, and this was another, I say, like kind of like a spiritual experience. I did my first speaker meeting where I spoke at a meeting. This is pre-pandemic, so it was a regular meeting in person. And I spoke for the first time and told my story. And I was nervous about doing that. And it went really well. And then I say this for me, ever since I did that, that was, I think, in September. So it was a couple months in. Ever since I did that, the obsession to drink was lifted. And I can't explain that either. I don't know. I don't know why. I just, you know, I started noticing I was getting angry and agitated at stuff, but I wasn't thinking about drinking. I didn't want to drink. And I wouldn't even realize until the next day. So like I might get pissed about something, and then the next day it would dawn on me, like, I didn't even think about drinking when I was like, and it was crazy. So it was just great, you know. So that was another, like, you know, kind of big moment for me in the early recovery, you know, that obsession to drink was lifted a few months in. But I say this too, and you'll hear a lot of people say this, obviously, of course, you doing this podcast, you talk to so many people, you know, the hard work really started then for me, you know. Yeah. Like it was like, I thought not picking up a drink at the beginning was hard. And it was, listen, I'm not taking away from that. It was really hard. And that emotional roller coaster was really hard, but it was a different kind of hard, you know. Then I had to start really looking at myself and my thinking and who I was and how I thought. And that was real. And now I'm still working on that. I mean, obviously, I mean, I'll spend a lifetime working on it, but that was when I started really putting the work into changing how I thought about life and the world and people, mm-hmm. and trying to rewire my brain, which is still an ongoing process.
Yeah. So you, the obsession to drink was lifted. Miracle. And then now you've been working on you know, peeling the layers. Right. And so, yep. So tell me about how that's been like. How has life changed since you've been really uncovering Chris?
It's calmer because I'm calmer. You know, like I went through the steps. I started the steps that fall, you know, probably about 6 months or so in. I started the steps with my sponsor. I went through the steps. It took me about a year and a half to get through the steps. I kind of just did them for me. I just did them organically. I just did them as I did them. And it just organically kind of happened over a year and a half where I got through the steps. And with my sponsor and everything like that. And I saw that I did that. But you know, with that, as we know, comes the hard thing that we have to do is really take a look at our character defects and what our role is in any conflicts we have with other people or resentments we have towards other people, what our role is in it. So it really forced me, the step work really forced me to look at myself. And, you know, and I realized that, one of my big character defects was anger and not being patient, you know, just being impatient and, you know, being judgmental. And I mean, listen, there was a lot of character. I realized I had more character defects than I thought, but it was good. You know, like I just started learning to not react so impulsively, you know, like if I would get angry, I would learn. I still work at it, you know, but I mean that restraint of pen and tongue, you know, and these days, you know, it's probably more so restraint of text and tongue, you know?
Yeah.
But I just, I'm calmer. I'm more mellow. So like, I'm not, and I still have my moments, you know, obviously I'm human, but overall I feel like that's the kind of trajectory that I'm on. Like I don't get as worked up worked up as quickly, as bad as I would if I, I do have my moments where I do get worked up and I get pissed and I'm whatever, but I don't allow myself to stay in those moments. But that's what I really work at, I work at that, it's because that's not my natural state,
Must be so more comfortable.
Calmer. Yeah. And if I had to pick one word for, how it's been and how it's changed, calmer.
Yeah. Yeah. You were a real spaz when I first met you. I'm just kidding. No, when I first met you, I could tell you were so willing. You were like you just wanted to figure out how to just be relieved of like the shackles. Like I could just tell right from the beginning that you were I just don't want to be enchained anymore.
Yeah. That gift of desperation. I definitely had it. I was pretty much like, tell me what to do. Tell me what to do.
Yeah. So has it been worth it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was just telling somebody the other day, I love being sober. Another thing that, you hear a lot, and I definitely felt that was when you come into and get sober and come into recovery is you have that fear of how am I going to have fun?
Right.
Without alcohol, So I definitely felt that. I was like, oh my God, how am I going to have fun ever again if I can't drink, Cause that's all all the fun stuff, most of it revolved around drinking,
Right.
And I realize now 2 years later, I kind of laugh at that because I realize now 2 years later, I realize now that that's just, obviously it's not true. I love being sober. I love that my life isn't that chaotic mess that it was. It had become for so many years. A good friend of mine in the program that has a little bit more time than I do, when I first came in and we started to become friends, he said to me, where you're at in 6 months, you're not going to be able to imagine it. And then when you're at 6 months, you're not going to be able to imagine where you're at. At 1 year, you're going to, and then where you're at 1 year, you're not going to be able to imagine where you're at 2 years. And I see what he means, but again, it's like I said, with that, earlier about picking up the phone and instead of picking up a drink, people can tell you that till you're blue in the face, but until you start experiencing that and seeing that for yourself, at least for me, that's really, that's what kept me coming and keeps me coming is everything everyone's told me has kind of happened pretty much.
And you've been willing from the beginning, just as my perspective is like, you're one of those people that, because you were so desperate, really wanting to be relieved of the shackles of the drink and the bondage of self, et cetera, and basically saying like, tell me what to do. I'll do it. And then you share, you say like, listen, I did this and it works and I feel better. You just have to kind of let go of your will and trust other people, and right. What they're telling you. And you've been such an example of just really being like, yeah, fucking tell me what to do and I'll do it. And you take suggestions and you do it and you take a look at yourself. So it's been awesome to watch you change over the past couple of years. But you still have that willingness every day, that willingness to take a look at yourself and see what do I need to do to continue to grow along spiritual lines. And that's something that's really unique. That's a hard place to put yourself, especially when, it makes, for me, I know it's like you kind of present as not you personally, but in general, it's like you're raw, you're vulnerable, and that can be scary, but that's really where the growth comes from.
Yeah, it definitely, if I didn't have that willingness, I wouldn't have stayed sober. Also for me, so much of what I did for a living was intertwined with, what I did for a living made me suspicious of everybody. I didn't trust people. I didn't trust anybody because you were trained not to trust anybody, in my line of work, So, you know, so I was always spent my whole life very suspicious of people, very suspicious of people's motives. You know, why does this person want to help me? Why is this person being so nice? You know, I didn't trust people. And I had to really force myself to overcome that and kind of just, like you said, kind of just open myself and just say, you know what, whatever, man, like, just tell me what to do. And, but, no, it was definitely hard, but, obviously so worth it, you know, because if I didn't do that, I don't think I'd still be sober now, you know?
Yeah, it's awesome. I'm psyched for you. And you just went through a big surgery.
Yeah. So I had a pretty major spinal surgery. It was like a 7-hour surgery on my neck. I used a lot of the stuff that I learned in recovery, you know, to kind of help me get through what was a difficult time just physically, you know, and then also mentally, you know. I couldn't, in the beginning, I couldn't, you know, I still have weakness in my left arm, but I wasn't able to lift my left arm up higher than my shoulder and touch my head. And then eventually when I was able to do that, it was like a big deal. And so like it, you know, and I shared this, I think at yesterday's meeting that we were on, you know, gratitude, you know, it makes you grateful for the little things, you know, that you realize that, you know, just being able to touch your head with your hand, you know, like who would have thought, like that would have been a big deal for me. And I'd be like, oh my God, this is great. I can touch my head with, like, which I can do now, you know, but I wouldn't have had that attitude if it wasn't for recovery. I would have been very negative. I would have been like, just in a dark, I know, because that's how I live my life. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Having a good attitude when you're going through significant health issues, if you're in the hospital for whatever reason, and, or you're dealing with a sickness or a chronic illness, I think attitude is huge. And the program of recovery that we work, it's a design for living. And so it's like very helpful in teaching us, like you said, how to cope with difficult situations. And if we have a piss poor attitude about, like, you know, being prone for several weeks in the hospital as you're recovering from something, it's not going to help the recovery process. It's going to slow it. At least that's just my, I guess, personal opinion.
No, I agree. I think it's, you know, I it's my opinion too, but I think it's also been, I'm certainly no scientist or anything like that, but I mean, I think there's definitely, it's been researched, the connection between mental health and physical health. I mean, you know, I always say this, like, if you're in pain, it's hard to be in a good mood, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, really, but you know, I had one day that was a very depressing, dark day for me where it kind of changed everything for me because I spent the whole day just in a really dark place, depressed. And then I don't know what happened. I just had to kick myself and say, and I realized that 70% of my recovery was going to be mental. You know, the physical recovery, you know, was going to and is still going to come as it comes, you know, and there's certain things I can do to kind of help that along, which I've been doing. But, you know, 70% of the recovery for me, you know, I felt like I said, it's mental, you know, I have to keep my head in a good place.
Yeah.
You know, and so that was important to me. But again, something I have to work at, like, it's not my natural default state to be positive. You know?
Right. Right. But it gets easier. I mean, that's my experience has been, it's like, I have new defaults that are more positive than from when I first came into the program. So that's, right. That's like the beauty of long-term sobriety. It's just that these new defaults occur and it just makes life a lot easier to live. That's right. Awesome.
Yeah. And I still feel like I'm such an infant in sobriety and recovery, you know, so I still feel like I have such a long way to go and, which is good, you know, but, you know, I definitely, you know, I can definitely see that the change is for the better, mm-hmm. you know, and who I am and how I react to the world and stuff like that. Yeah. So, but I, you know, I have definitely have a way to go.
Well, you've come so far, and I'm just so psyched that you, because I asked you to be on my podcast a while ago. It was too soon. And you sought me out and said, I'm ready now. And that's so great. And I think that's a, you know, it's a sign of how far you have come that, you know, it is hard in the beginning when we first get sober, there's a lot of shame. And I know that, like I work with women who are, you know, and men reach out to me who are very ashamed. They feel such shame because they can't get their drinking under control.
Right.
And I get that. I mean, I totally get that because for years, I, like you said, Chris, too, it's like you, I wanted to, you know, control my drinking my way. I wanted to try to stop my way, and it never really worked.
The big lie is you think you can.
Right.
You know, I mean, from like, you think you can, like I thought before I came into recovery that I just, you know, I kept doing the same thing with the same results. I kept stopping. Mm-hmm. Convincing myself that I wasn't going to drink anymore. And then slowly after a period of time, whether it was 1 month or 2 months or 3 months, I would start, you know, the disease in me would start convincing me that, you know what, you start making those deals with yourself. You know what, I'll just stay away from shots and I'll be good. I won't get crazy because I get crazy when I do shots. So I just won't do shots. Or, you know, I'll just drink when I go out with friends. I won't drink at home alone. You know, you start making these, I did, you know, I can't speak for anybody else, but, you know, obviously we hear this a lot in recovery. You know, a lot of people talk about this, and it certainly was the case for me. You know, I would make all these deals with myself and bargain with myself in my head. And then after a few months, you know, we have that built-in forgetter where we forget how bad it was getting, mm-hmm. you know, and I felt that. I mean, that happened with me, you know, and then next thing you know, you're like, I can have a beer. Right. You know, it's just, I'll have a beer too. It's not going to be like it was.
Right. You think it's going to be different. Yeah.
Like it's gonna be different.
This time it'll be different. This time I won't drink a 30 pack.
Right. Exactly. You know,
60 pack.
Not back 15 shots after that. You know, that's the big lie, you know, but you don't know, you don't learn about all that stuff until you come into recovery. Right. You know, like you don't learn. You know, once you hear other, that's the beauty of going into recovery and going to meetings is you hear other people that you share the same type of stories and feelings, and everyone's mm-hmm. story is different, obviously, but like, you know, the very similar experiences. That was a big thing for me too, is when I, started going to my first few meetings, I saw, you know, all walks of life. I mean, I saw that the disease doesn't discriminate. You know, it doesn't matter how much money you have, what color you are, what religion you belong to. It doesn't matter, you know, how educated you are. It doesn't discriminate. And it kind of hit home for me, you know. And then, you know, you go to meetings. For me, one way that I benefit from meetings is, you know, reminds me that I'm not alone. You know, you hear other people tell their stories and you hear them, you know, say things that you're like, oh my God, that was me. That's what I thought. That's what I thought that. That's exactly, I did that, you know? And it's like, and so that, you know, I think that creates a natural bond. You know, when you have shared experiences, I think with any group of people, when you have shared experiences, you know, you develop a bond, you know? And I felt that, you know? And I felt it pretty quickly. Cause I saw it right away. My first meeting, I saw it. I was like, I remember the first meeting, every share, I was like, oh my God, that's me. Oh my God, that's me. Holy shit. That's me. I remember.
Yeah. That's great that you could do that. A lot of people compare rather than identify, and that makes it more difficult to get to a recovered state. So, Chris, what do you do for fun now? Or is your life really boring? Like life really is boring, right? Like,
I mean,
no laughter anymore. Nothing's joyful.
Yeah, I mean, this pandemic, my God. But I feel like life's finally starting to get back to normal. You know, I play music. You know, I play music. I write music. When I got sober, I also started a band. I'm a drummer, first and foremost, but I also play guitar and I write music and so I kind of that's what I do for fun. I play music, I write music, I record music, you know, that's, and then and of course, you know, just you know, spending time with my kids, and you know, just, you know, it's a kind of a tough question that these days, because coming out of this pandemic, it's like, it's, you know, it's a weird, it's like, usually you could, I could feel like I could easily answer like, what do I do for fun? But like, it's been it's been such a stagnant year and a half, you know?
Yeah.
But
well, no, like me, like I, there's a lot of things I do for fun. And during the pandemic, like I hear, like, I was just listening to a part of a podcast and they were complaining about COVID and and saying like it was such a shit ass year and it sucked and, you know, like all this negative stuff about the pit. And I don't know, I didn't mind it. Like, I mean, yeah, it sucked. Like, it sucked because people died and there was a lot of shit going down that was ugly, but you know, I had control. I could turn off the TV. I could, right, you know, read books or spend more quality time with my kids, or, you know, there's things that you can do that, that are fun, that for me, at least, like nothing else was fun in the world except for drinking. So now it's like everything I do, like doing this right now, I'm having a blast. You know, this is fun.
Well, it also gave you, I think it also gave you, the pandemic gave you an opportunity to kind of dive into this a little bit more, no?
Well, no, actually, initially, I think March into April, I stopped interviewing because I was getting my kids settled. Like, we were just kind of adjusting to this new way of living and new way of doing school. And once they were settled and we were in that routine, then I started to pick up episodes again. But yeah, my recovery changed a lot too, because I got involved with groups all like across the country and met some amazing people all over the world. So it's been a grand year for that.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is like it's like how do you, it's all boils down to how do you look at it, you know? I mean, for me, it gave me an opportunity. I couldn't play with my band anymore. You know, I play drums in the band, and I you know, I couldn't, you know, we had to take a pause, but what I did was I started writing acoustic music and at home and by myself and recording acoustic music and doing, you know, pretty much like a one-stop shop of everything. And just, you know, and I dove into that. I dove into my songwriting, you know, and my acoustic music is more mellow, than what I do with my band. So it was a great outlet because it was more, my acoustic music is more personal. It's more mellow. Mm-hmm. So it's like, yeah, it's like, how do you, you know, you could look at all the, it's like, how do you look at it? You could look at it like, and nobody's, like you said, obviously nobody's discounting how horrible COVID is and was, you know, and how many people died and got sick and all that sort of stuff, you know, but for me, you know, yeah, I look at it like I dove into my recovery more too. You know, I dove into my music and my recovery. I mean, I was doing 2 meetings, sometimes 3 meetings a day in the early pandemic.
Yeah.
I mean, I probably did two back-to-back 90 and 90s, more than that. You know, I mean, so I dove, you know, on Zoom, you know, so I dove into my recovery, more than I was able, because I wasn't working, you know, I haven't worked since the pandemic hit. So I dove into my recovery and I kind of immersed myself in that. And my music. So it's like you said, it's like, you know, you can have a pissy attitude, you know, and there were days I did, you know, but you know, overall, like, you know, that's what we do. We try to work on our thinking, you know, and
right. And we're not perfect. We're going to be pissy. Right.
And I say that too all the time. It's like, you know, like that was a big thing for me. Like when I first came into recovery, I thought I had to do everything perfectly. I thought I had to be like this very, you know, I would see people with like, you know, 20, 30 years and they just seemed like these Zen people, and I was like, I want to be like that. Like, I'm not like, I'm so fucking crazy. Like, I want to be like that. I you know, I don't want to, you know, lose my shit over every little thing. And, you know, I start yelling and screaming. Like, I want to be like that. And so then I, you know, and I had to catch myself, because in early recovery, I would pressure myself to do everything perfectly, you know? And that was another thing that took time. Like, you know, my sponsor always would say to me is, you know, put the bat down, you know, because I would beat myself up if I didn't do everything perfectly, how I perceived it to be perfect, mm-hmm. In sobriety, you know? So it took me, you know, probably over, it was really this past year where I started learning to cut myself a break, you know, and acceptance. I, you know, accepting that I'm not perfect. I'm never going to be perfect. I'm never going to be like a monk, this Zen-like monk that never gets aggravated or irritated or jealous, or, you know, that's just not like, I allow myself to feel all those emotions because I'm human. Mm-hmm. And it kind of is what got me in trouble in the first place. I spent so many years stuffing emotions down. So I allow myself to feel those emotions. I don't allow myself to stay in those places.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like I would, in the past, I would get angry and I would stew for 2-3 days,
mm-hmm.
be in a bad mood for 2-3 days. Now I'll get angry and I may rant and rave a little bit, and I'm, because I'm human. But I come out of it much quicker, an hour, mm-hmm. hour and a half. And I'm like, all right, I'm over it.
Yeah. So it gets uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it gets uncomfortable to be stuck in those emotions. Like,
yeah,
I don't shake it off like a wet dog, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's a good analogy. Yeah. Like you just want to shake it off, you know? So, but in the beginning, I thought I couldn't allow myself to feel any of that stuff. You know, then I realized, like, no, like, I'm gonna have times when I'm angry. I'm gonna have times when I'm sad. I'm gonna have times when I'm feeling jealous of what this person has or is able to do and I can't do. Like, I'm human.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I think that's a big part of recovery too, is allowing yourself to be human and, mm-hmm. and putting the bat down and not beating yourself up over every little thing.
Yeah.
You know, I know that's been a big part of what I've been working on too, you know?
Okay. So let's wrap things up. We've been talking a while and a lot of good stuff we've been talking about, and I really appreciate your time, Chris.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Yeah. So just the last question I want to ask before we wrap things up. So you were obviously, if people didn't intuit from the past hour, that you were a cop. You still are. You're a retired cop. Or do, yes. I need to edit this out?
No. I spent 25 years. I retired, and I guess I still am kind of part-time. I was working at a school as a school resource officer before the pandemic hit, because in New Jersey, the schools will hire retired police officers to work in the school. Yeah. So I was doing that for a few months and the pandemic hit. So I haven't done that, you know, since the pandemic hit, but I'll be going back to that in September. So
that's awesome.
So it's like, I'm kind of, I still have one foot in it.
Yeah. So I guess my question is regarding that is that, you know, police officers, they need to use, I think society, we look at them as like they need to have a lot of, you know, show power and force and control to resolve situations and need to be tough. And so for you as a police officer to find recovery and to let go of control and be willing to, you know, give your power away. I know there's a lot of people who are like, I'm not joining it. I'm not getting involved. I want my power. Like, I am powerful. I'm a warrior because I'm sober. Like, what do you have anything you can say about that as being somebody like, so for example, if there's a young guy who's a cop, who's struggling with alcohol, like what would you say to them about recovery?
That's a great question. You know, in so many ways, what I did for a living, you know, working in law enforcement, you have to think differently than you have to think in recovery. So I've often wondered, like, how, if I was still working and doing that job, like, you know, really, and not like I said, the last few years I was in an office, but really out there on the street, like, how would I be with my recovery? I've kind of wondered that, like, you know, because your mindset has to be, to keep you alive, you have to be suspicious of people. You have to not trust people. You have to be on guard. And that's, you know, it's not even a control. It's, you have to control situations, because we're taught that if a situation gets out of control, that's when it could be dangerous and you could get hurt or killed.
Right.
So you have to take control of the scene. You have to take control of the situation. So you're trained to do that, and it's drilled into you. You know, you have to always be in control of that scene, because it's really just for safety reasons, you know, because if it gets out of control, now somebody could get hurt. So, so a lot of the thinking that you need to be successful in that line of work, just is so opposed to the thinking that we have in recovery. You know, it's just, it's completely opposite. And, what advice I would give to, if there was a young police officer that was struggling with alcohol is there's no shame in getting help. You know, there's no shame in getting help. And I guess that would be the kind of the broad message that I would have, you know. The nature of that type of work definitely changes who you are and how you view the world and how you view people. It can't not. You know, because you're exposed to really the horrible parts of humanity. So, and after years and years of that, it's going to change you, and you don't even realize it's changing you as it's happening. You know, it's for me at least. It wasn't until I retired and got into recovery that I'm able to look back and realize how much that job and that line of work changed me. And it's becoming less and less, but in that profession, the policing and law enforcement, there's always been a stigma that you don't ask for help. You're the one that people ask for help. That is starting to change here in this country, you know, slowly, which is good. You know, people are starting to talk about the mental health aspect of law enforcement and policing, and that's a good thing, obviously, but there's a long way to go. So, you know, I would, my advice would be, if anybody who is in that line of work, who is struggling with anything, there's no shame in getting help. It takes more courage to get help than it does to try to tough it out, quote unquote. I also see a therapist, you know? So like I have no problem telling people that, you know, I see a therapist, which helps in addition to my recovery program. So,
That's awesome.
There's no shame in getting help. You know, it's a tough job, and you see a lot and you're exposed to a lot, and you're only human. So,
Well, I appreciate you saying that, Chris, because, you know, time and time again, I will ask my guests or just people I'm just talking to randomly, like, what kind of advice would you offer? The question I just asked you, and the answer is always the same, and it involves letting go of trying to figure things out yourself and asking for help. It's the same answer, no matter what profession or field you're coming from. I'm always hearing the same exact thing, that is, this is a disease that it's no human power can really fully heal you. And this is my experience. No human power could heal me of what was ailing me. And I needed support to get to a better place, spiritually, emotionally, mentally. And so I appreciate you sharing that, because really there is no shame in asking for help.
No. And when you're younger, it's hard. It's hard to think like that. But I think, you know, for me, as I get older, you know, I've realized that more and more. You know, I was, obviously in my 20s, I was much more hard-headed, and back then that sort of stuff wasn't talked about, you know,
right.
But No, there's not. It's, you know, like I said, I'll say this again, you know, I had two good friends of mine who I worked with who committed suicide, you know, and I can't say who's an alcoholic and who's not, but they were big drinkers, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
You know, one of them was drunk, really drunk on a Sunday afternoon at the very time that he did it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to anybody who's in that line of work and in my line of work in policing and law enforcement, you know, I've seen what happens, you know, when that disease takes you and when everything that, you know, the job and the disease and all that stuff and that macho attitude of feeling like you can't ask for help. I've seen what can happen, and it's tragic.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, it's not easy to ask for help, but once you do, it's like a whole weight's lifted. Yeah. And I'm sure everybody feels like that. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Chris. Thank you so much for taking the time today to share your story.
I appreciate coming on. Yeah. I heard so many of your podcasts, and I've just been dragging my feet, like you said. You said it in a nicer way, but I'll say I was dragging my feet. You know, I'm coming on, but I'm honored. I'm honored.
Oh, yeah. No.
You're like famous, right?
Oh, God, just stop.
You're like famous.
All right, here's where enter sarcasm.
I can't have a conversation without no sarcasm. They got a very sanitized version of me. You know that.
I do. Okay, well, you have an awesome day. What are you planning on going out in the heat and the humidity? Going for a run?
No, I mean, I walked the dog earlier. No, it's so hot out. We just got a pool, so I may go in the pool a little bit, but then nice. Just get the kids from school and not much. Yeah. Not too much today, so.
Oh, good. But well, thank you. It's been great. All right. Well, everyone, everyone listening, I hope this conversation was something that gave you hope and inspiration that life is possible in sobriety. A happy life is possible in sobriety, and it's worth it, as we just heard. If you want to, if you have any questions or concerns or comments or anything about this podcast episode, please, you can reach out to me at sobergratitudes@gmail.com or so at the Instagram account, sober_gratitudes. And Chris, I don't know, are you open to giving out your Instagram handle, or is that?
Yeah, you could. Yeah. It's.
I'll just put it in the show notes.
I don't remember what it is right now. Yeah, you can put it in there. Yeah, you can.
I'll put in the show notes.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, great.
So, thank you, Sarah.
Yeah, have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. All right. Bye. Well, that's a wrap on this episode. Thank you to my guest and all of you for listening. I hope what you heard inspires you to look for and recognize the gifts of sobriety. Sober Gratitudes, a podcast dedicated to delivering messages of hope through true stories of recovery. A sober life is possible if you truly want it. Sober Gratitudes is a podcast dedicated to spreading the hope in recovery from addiction. It is an inclusive show that does not promote or represent any recovery program. When my guests and I discuss what keeps us sober, we are referring to our own unique experiences. Our goal is to encourage and give hope to those who are struggling and need support.